What's the universal time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. The Pentagon appoints a 3-star general. He's Lieutenant General Jeffrey Buchanan to lead all the military hurricane response efforts in Puerto Rico. The Trump administration had been criticized for not responding more quickly to the crisis in the U.S. territory, which was hit hard by Hurricane Maria on September 17th. On Thursday, Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert defended the 8-day period between the declaration of an emergency in Puerto Rico and the naming of a leader for recovery efforts, and said that Homeland Security Director Elaine Due.
You are seeing devastation in Puerto Rico. That is the fault of the hurricane. The relief effort is under control. It is proceeding very well, considering the devastation that took place.
Representatives from social media platform Twitter told a House and Senate Intelligence Committee that it had shut down more than 200 accounts after determining that they were linked to Russia that sought to interfere in U.S. politics. The closed-door sessions followed similar briefings earlier this month with Facebook, which has also agreed to provide lawmakers with 3,000 Russia-linked ads involving divisive social and political issues that were placed on its platform. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis has made an unannounced visit to Qatar, holding talks with the country's emir and defense minister at the largest U.S. military base in the Middle East. Mattis renewed a call for unconditional dialogue to help end a crisis involving Qatar and 4 Arab states. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates cut ties with Qatar in June over its close ties to Iran and alleged support for extremists there. More at VOANews.com. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is on his second trip to China, seeking Beijing's cooperation on maximum pressure campaigns against North Korea's nuclear aggression amid heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula. In a meeting with the Chinese Vice Premier Liu Yandong on the top U.S. diplomat, they're seeking China's cooperation to curb North Korea's nuclear provocations and pave a way for President Donald Trump's first visit to China in November. After President Trump last week issued a new executive order giving the United States greater leverage over foreign banks that support the North Korean regime, the U.S. has now started looking at implementing tougher sanctions. Susan Thornton, acting Assistant Secretary of State for Asian and Pacific Affairs, told a congressional committee the administration is working with allied countries to try to ferret out in these illicit underground networks, in her words, used by North Korea to subvert previous sanctions. Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Turkish counterpart Recep Tayyip Erdogan Thursday agreed to push for the creation of a de-escalation zone in Syria's key northern province of Idlib to help end the civil war there. Erdogan said after talks in Ankara that the pair agreed to pursue more intensely the implementation of the de-escalation zone in Idlib, which currently is under jihadist control.
The Kurdistan regional government has in fact thrown itself into the middle of the fire with its senseless attempt at independence. I don't accept anyone's independence.
After several hours of talks over dinner, the two leaders underlined the importance of the deepening relationship between the two countries. A UN visit to Myanmar's troubled Rakhine State was postponed Thursday due to bad weather. Word of that delay comes one day after the UN said its representatives would be accompanied by Myanmar government officials in the visit there. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley.
The United States is providing $95 million to support urgent humanitarian needs in Burma and Bangladesh. But given the likelihood of more people fleeing across the border, plus the ongoing monsoon season and the humanitarian need already present in Bangladesh, this generosity will not be enough.
Approximately 400 people have been killed in subsequent clashes. Satellite images released by rights group Amnesty International have shown entire Rohingya villages burned. U.S. Congressman Steve Scalise has returned to the House of Representatives for the first time since being shot on June 14th. Telling colleagues he is a living example that miracles do happen. I am Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya's main opposition coalition walked out of negotiations on election rerun.
The chairman did emphasize that in the subsequent meeting, he would be happy to have the police president of Uhuru Kenyatta and Raila Odinga attend the meeting.
Andrew Limo is spokesman for Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission. Uganda media advocates condemned a decision to ban live broadcast of ongoing age limit debate in parliament. 93-year-old Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe vows not to relinquish the presidency. And the UNDP says income inequality in Africa hurts poverty reduction and achievement of sustainable development goals.
Specifically, we have 7 outliers. Once you remove these outliers out of Africa, then income level in Africa remains at the average of the global level.
Ayodele Odusola is the chief economist for the United Nations Development Program Africa. And the United Nations says gender-based violence in South Sudan is high. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission says the October 26 presidential election rerun will proceed despite the collapse Thursday of talks between the ruling Jubilee Party, main opposition National Super Alliance, and officials of the electoral body. The commission has also expressed concern about what it describes as the hardline stance the two parties took during the talks. This after representatives of the opposition party walked out of the talks, saying the ruling party seeks to manipulate the talks and the electoral process ahead of the vote. Andrew Limo, spokesman for the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, tells viewers Peter Clotty that the electoral body will not be deterred in its determination to organize and administer the presidential election rerun.
Well, I think the chairman was saying in the spirit of the Supreme Court ruling, because under constitution that we are supposed to conduct an election 60 days after the ruling. And so he was saying we would be in breach of the law, we would be in contempt of court if we don't do it. And so he was emphasizing to all the parties that we have a job to do and we must accomplish within that timeline.
I understand the IEBC is trying to accommodate both parties in the spirit of unity to try to resolve any possible concerns in the run-up to the election. So what led to the breakdown and what are the steps moving forward to resolve this?
Well, I think the chairman and the commission in general have done a splendid job in trying to bring all the parties together, realizing how important this is for the country. And the chairman in particular reached out to them and said, and asked them to think about the country instead of pulling in different directions. And I think the fact that for 2 consecutive days they were able to come together, and though we didn't make much progress, I think to me it's a gesture of goodwill and that it is possible to make progress. The chairman did emphasize that in the subsequent meeting he would be happy to have the principals of Uhuru Kenyatta and Raila Odinga attending the meeting.
Have you gotten any signal from them that they are willing to sit down as the two principals, because that will serve as a strong signal to Kenyans? Any signal from them at all?
I think that observation largely reflects the reality. Whether the two principals will be coming to sit on a table with the commission is something I cannot confirm at this point. But that's our hope, that's our prayer, that is what we are asking them to do.
Andrew, how are preparations for the October 26th presidential rerun? How are preparations so far?
Yeah, the preparation is going on well. Even late at this time, I've just left the office and I've left some people working on the logistics and all that. The training has been going on. We have trained the master trainers. And what we are very keen in is to try to avoid some of the mistakes that came in, and some obviously were things that would be avoided. I would give you just a very simple example. We had self-carbonated foam, the result foam, and it was made in such a way that we didn't want to introduce errors based on what happened in 2013. And the requirement was that once you fill in, you would make about 6 copies, because of each carbonation. But the problem is some of our clerks did fill the forms correctly. But when it came to stamping them, they also assumed that it would make 6 copies by stamping instead of stamping each paper individually. I mean, you would look at it and that really looks like a very petty mistake, and but in the legal terms, it's a big issue. And this is what we are trying to emphasize, going through the recommendations one by one and ensuring that that is really emphasized to our officials here.
So what should Kenyans look forward to in the rerun of the presidential election?
Yeah, I think as the chairman has said, we are preparing because the laws that are in place are sufficient. We would expect far more. You know, every election there is an improvement. Every election we learn from the past election, and there are many things that we see clearly how to do it and how to do it better. It can only get better.
Andrew Limo is the spokesman for the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission of Kenya. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Nairobi. Media advocates in Uganda have condemned a directive by the Uganda Communications Commission, or the UCC, to stop live radio and television broadcasts of the ongoing age-limit debate in Parliament. The commission says live broadcasts incite the public, but media practitioners say the directive curtails freedom of the press and deprives journalists of their duty to inform the public. Mugumi Davis Rakarinch reports from Kampala.
UCC gave the directive on Tuesday ahead of heated parliamentary debate on the constitution amendment. Maurice Mojisha, a news manager at NTV, one of the popular private televisions in Uganda, says UCC threatened to revoke their operating license unless they stopped live broadcasts of events.
We think it was very unfair and is against all form of freedom of expression, which is enshrined in our constitution. What happened yesterday was that we failed our viewers and failed the Ugandans by failing to show them what was happening in a public institution.
Tony Mwangala, the chief editor of BBC Telefinya Eyafe Television, another media house that brought... provided live broadcasts, agrees with Mujisha. He says as a result, BBS has lost viewers and clients.
As a TV station, we are selling the numbers. If you have the numbers, then you have the sponsors. If you don't have the numbers, then you don't have the sponsors. They walk away. So in that regard, sponsors are not looking at us in a different way. I mean, if you don't have the nerves to put it up there, why would I have the nerve to give you my money?
Mujisha caused the incident uncalled for and unfortunate.
Our credibility as an organization and media organizations is at stake. We should have, our viewers are saying we should have stood up for freedom of the media and expression of the for the people, so that we either would have, of course, been lost our license or, you know, broadcast stopped, which would then mean that we do not have, this kind of organization in place.
He says this could be just the beginning of the government crackdown on media organizations in Uganda. But UCC head Godfrey Mutabazi blames media organizations of lacking competency and that they breach the minimum broadcasting standards.
The Ugandan media does not have pre-listening facility like you do have in Voice of America and other organizations, whereby hateful speech or distasteful speech can be edited out. For our media here, they throw out everything, they let everything go through without any notice. They must be professional. We've given them enough time. Let them do decent things. Let them stop inciting public to violence, and then we move forward as a country.
Both Mujisha and Mwangala say they are still consulting with their lawyers if they should take a legal action against the directive. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakalinji in Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 29th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe's 93-year-old president, Robert Mugabe, who has been in power for more than 37 years, says he will not relinquish power as he was elected by the people. Mr. Mugabe, speaking Thursday, accused some in the ruling ZANU-PF party of trying to remove him through unconstitutional means amid serious economic problems in the country. Gabe Dube of U.S. Zimbabwe Service reports.
Allegations that Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe is fighting for his political survival within his ruling ZANU-PF party were validated Thursday when the 93-year-old leader took the opportunity at a state burial to put his detractors on notice. Using biblical references, as he did during the 72nd United Nations General Assembly last week, President Mugabe spoke of traitors within his inner circle who are plotting against him.
Jesus last supper.
There are some, like those Jesus spoke about at the Last Supper, that those we eat with, they are the ones who will betray me. The likes of Judas Iscariot are among us. So those ones, let us expose them and embarrass them. Others want to see a change of government, one that will bring in new leadership, saying the president should leave his seat.
With the crowd cheering him on, President Mugabe was officiating over the burial of Mrs. Maria Msika, the wife of former late Vice President Joseph Msika, at the National Heroes Acre in Harare, told his nameless detractors that he has the political mandate to lead, and it would be the Zimbabwean people who will change that.
I was given this seat by the people. It's the people's seat, and I don't want with my seat. When the day comes to step down, I will say thank you to all the people of Zimbabwe.
President Robert Mugabe also addressed the growing food, fuel and cash shortages in the country, which he said is the work of detractors trying to destabilize the country.
There are those who are eager to manipulate the currency.
There are those who want to mess up gifts from God. So that they can those who want to inflation. Play with our money. Manipulating the currency so that they can trigger inflation, cause panic buying. Those are the shenanigans in our midst.
Shortages of the quasi-currency bond notes as well as the United States dollar have given rise to illicit black markets, resulting in the further scarcity of both. The government has promised a crackdown on anyone found to be hoarding food, cash or other supplies that have created shortages as seen during the period of historic hyperinflation in 2008. Reporting for VOA, I'm Kip Stube in Washington, D.C.
The United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, says African countries must address the challenge of income inequality if they are to make progress towards poverty reduction and achieving the Sustainable Development Goals. In a new report, UNDP says income inequality in African countries stems from a highly dualistic economic structure where high-income sectors such as multinational companies and the extractive sector offer limited capacity to generate employment and where most of the workforce earns far lower incomes. Ayodele Odusola, chief economist for UNDP Africa, says the problem is most acute in some eastern and southern African countries where land and socioeconomic assets are highly concentrated in the hands of a few.
Income inequality is very high in Africa, and as a matter of fact, the continent is considered to be one of the most unequal continents in the world. 10 of the 19 most unequal countries are in Africa. And specifically, we have 7 outliers. These countries are South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, Lesotho, Comoros, and Central African Republic. Once you remove these outliers out of Africa, then income level in Africa remains at the average of the global level. The good news is that between 1990 and 2011, the continent was able to reduce inequality by 3.4 Gini, which is one of the highest in terms of reduction.
You mentioned some countries, particularly in the Southern African region, calling them the outlier countries.
Yes.
What is their role in this income inequality in Africa?
These seven outliers are the countries where there is high level of income inequality. Number one of them, which is more or less the most unequal country in the world, is South Africa. The others are Namibia, Botswana, Zambia, Lesotho, Central African Republic, as well as Comoros. If you look at
this, what accounts for this income inequality in this region?
For instance, if you look at this, the Southern African countries experience apartheid. And in most countries, this is where land is concentrated in the hands of very few people. For instance, if you look at South Africa, it's a situation whereby 0.05% of the population is controlling more than 19% of the land, and which is one thing that people need to really break poverty and inequality. And if you compare it with Western African countries where land ownership is communal, then you have the large concentration of countries with low level of inequality.
What roles, if any, can African governments play to reverse this? I know you talk about the issue of land. What can African countries themselves do?
Thank you very much. That's a very good one. Ethiopia provides a very good example. Ethiopia, because of its socialist orientation, has a kind of communal land system. But again, what they've done recently is that in order to make sure people have access to land, they did what we call land reallocation with titling and registration, which is very helpful, not only serving as collateral in banks and financial institutions for them to access capital, but also for enhanced productivity.
So what do you recommend in terms of how this income inequality in Africa can be minimized?
So what we found in the book is that there's no silver bullet to addressing income inequality in Africa. But I want to suggest that based on what we have in the book, promoting tree of equity that falls on four branches. One, the issue of growth branch, where we advocate for the need to African government to modernize agriculture, diversify their economy by adding values, and stop exporting primary commodities. The second branch relates to the population branch. We need to really manage the fertility rate. What we found is that countries with high level of fertility have highest level of poverty in Africa.
Ayodele Odusola is the chief economist for the United Nations Development Program, Africa. He was speaking with me from New York City. The United Nations says gender-based violence remains very high in South Sudan. As Nabio Biagio reports from Juba, UN officials say sexual violence against women and girls can be reduced by allowing more women to occupy top positions in government.
UN Population Fund gender analyst Viola Riak says gender-based violence is rampant across South Sudan.
In South Sudan, we have various types of gender-based violence, range from rape, physical assault, sexual assault. We have child marriage, which contribute the bigger form, and then domestic violence. And most of this violence are perpetrated by intimate partners.
A child protection specialist working with UNICEF in South Sudan says gender-based violence is not only widespread in South Sudan. Sir Eric Denter, who has worked in Guinea, Burundi, Ethiopia, and Haiti to reduce sexual violence, says, during the nearly 4 years of fighting in South Sudan, many women have been the victims of gender-based violence, or GBV.
You have complex factors that are perpetrating GBV in South Sudan, so the conflict, displacement, separation of families and communities. So I think this is the one of the differences that I have seen among the countries that I have been working in.
Denter says South Sudan has laws and regulations that are supposed to protect women and girls, but the laws are not enforced due in part to ongoing fighting. He says South Sudan can learn from other countries where gender-based violence was commonplace.
What South Sudan can learn from those countries is that once you are able to identify the issue and start to address the issue from the causes, then you can put systems in place that can respond. So which at the moment is a problem because of the war, because of insecurity, so access to most of the locations is difficult, and also response services are not there at the moment.
Joy Zakariawani is a program officer at UN Women in South Sudan. She says sexual violence can almost be eliminated in South Sudan if women are allowed to get directly involved in legislating and executing laws that fight gender-based violence.
That was Nabi Obiajo reporting from Juba, South Sudan. Five minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin with the fixtures in the CAF Champions League first leg semi-final matches scheduled for this weekend. USM Alger will lock horns with Wydad Casablanca in the 2017 CAF Champions League later tonight in the first semi-final leg match scheduled for the Stade de 5 Julien in the Algerian city of Algiers. Another rivalry will be renewed as Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel entertains Egyptian giant Al Ahly on Sunday at the Stade Olympique de Suez. Both sides have met nine times in previous CAF matches, including two CAF Champions League finals and a CAF Super Cup. Ghana's Minister of Youth and Sport, Isaac Asiama, says Ghana is ready to host the 2018 African Nations Championship CHAN for domestic players. Next year's continental competition is without a host country after the Confederation of African Football declared that Kenya will not be ready. Ghana Minister Asiama insists that the country is ready to host CHAN, having successfully staged the WAFA Cup of Nations earlier this month.
Ghana stands ready to host any CAF organized event or tournament. This country is prepared. We are ready for any tournament event that CAF intends to organize in this country. We've got the capacity to do that. We did it in 2008. It was marvelously done. The whole world praised Ghana. Recently, WAFU has been done fantastically. So we've got the capacity to host any event from CAF or any tournament from CAF. So this country stands ready.
South Africa have already declared that they have no intention of bidding for the tournament, leaving Ghana as one of the clear favorites to become the new host. Elsewhere, the Council of East and Central African Football Associations has named Kenya as host of its Senior Challenge Cup 2 years since it was last held in Ethiopia. The SECAFA Senior Challenge Cup, which brings together all the national teams of the 13 member countries, will be held in November and December 2017. Staying with football, Cameroon will now face Sierra Leone in the second rounds of the African qualifiers for the FIFA Under-20 World Cup in France 2018. The Cameroonian side reached the second rounds of the qualifiers without playing the return leg, thanks to their 9-0 thrashing of their Guinean counterparts during the first leg in Conakry. In athletics news, former Nigeria and Africa sprint queen Mary Onyali has faulted the growing instances where African athletes switch allegiance to compete for other countries. The bronze medalist in the 4x100m relay at the 1992 Olympic Games said athletes must consider what they stand to lose before running for another country.
I had every opportunity in the world when I was competing to switch nationality. I was offered everything under this planet, but my heart won't let me. We all are different. We all have our needs and our reason for switching. I don't encourage it.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission says the October 26 presidential election rerun will proceed despite the collapse Thursday of talks between the ruling Jubilee Party, main opposition National Super Alliance, and officials of the electoral body. And that's it for this Friday, September 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an inside look at Startup Africa, a nonprofit Delaware-based organization that supports youth in building business skills that foster financial independence, create jobs, and grow financial economies. A discussion on Startup Africa on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa.
Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.